Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to SBPRA Radio. I'm your host, Charles Green. Today we'll be speaking with author Thomas Hamilton about his book, Astronomical Numbers. Mr. Hamilton, do we have you on the line?
Yes, you do.
Hi, how are you today?
Very warm.
You're calling from New York, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And anything above 70
nice.
Degrees.
Oh,
I was going to say anything
okay.
above 70 degrees leaves me very uncomfortable.
Yes, it can be a bit sluggish. I'm actually in the south myself, so the heat is unbearable, but it's always that way. So I wanted to talk to you today about this book, Astronomical Numbers. Would you be able to tell our audience a little about it in your own words?
Well, the title is a deliberate pun because one usually says, you know, a number is an astronomical number if it's really large, you know, like the national debt is an astronomical number. But in fact, this is a book on important numbers in the field of astronomy. So, as I say, it's a pun. So we've got the numbers are for such things as the Earth's distance from the sun or the distance of any of the other planets from the sun, most of the moons, distances from their planets, and all the distances are given in both miles and in kilometers. So that if people are, in some part of the world where they use the metric system, the book is suitable for them as well as for Americans.
Terrific, terrific. So it's a compilation, from my reading of it, it's a compilation of essential numbers that basically you wouldn't be able to do any kind of astronomy without that starting point. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but so many of these numbers might take you a half hour to an hour or more to track down. Like if somebody's planning to look at some of the moons of Jupiter, it's going to take a good deal of time because there are so many moons of Jupiter. Included are the number of eclipses. How frequent are eclipses, not just on the Earth, but on the other planets also? After all, most of the planets have one or more moons. In fact, only the Earth has only one moon. So they all have eclipses. Some have a great many. Mars has close to 3.5 eclipses a day.
Wow.
We feel deprived. But,
yeah, no, I mean, that's one of those things that, you know, we get so so centered on our own worldview, especially those of us who are not in the science field, that reading something like this just, you know, makes you kind of realize the not only the enormity of things, but just the multiverse differences between these different planets and all of that, which I think the average person just, you know, you learn the names in school and it starts and ends there. But obviously this brings in both for the academic and the astronomer, clearly a source book, but even for the average reader, something that, to me at least, made me kind of reconsider our place in the whole spectrum, which just these numbers are so enormous. And how were you able to compile all of these? You said that it takes half an hour to do just one of them. What was your process?
Well, I have sources at NASA I was able to use. I have sources at various observatories I was able to use. And, for example, the number of eclipses that the Earth has. A former student of mine became NASA's resident expert on eclipses. So I simply used his work. I'm glad I gave him a good grade. But among the things in there, what is the tallest mountain on each of the planets or the moons that have been examined closely enough to say that we know what the biggest mountain is, or where are the largest craters? And that one's actually both of those are rather interesting. The highest mountain is not on a planet, it's on one of the moons. And the largest crater in the solar system is on one of the moons of Jupiter. And it isn't even Jupiter's largest moon. So things are not always where one might expect them.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'd say that for myself as well, the the geography of the planets is also something that I think the average reader, and kind of neophyte to science, definitely doesn't consider is all of the geology of these objects as planets in themselves. So your study is on the more mathematical side, but I'm assuming that your background deals with the planets in more in depth and the knowledge about them in general. So what is your background or your focus as an astronomer? Are you specialized in a certain field of astronomy?
Well, let's see. I graduated from Columbia University, got my degrees there. And after I finished at Columbia, I was hired to work on the Apollo project. So this sort of date me, I guess. But I was the only astronomer in a group of about 40 people, engineers, a couple of mathematicians, a couple of computer programmers, a geologist. But I was the only astronomer in the group. This was at Grumman Aircraft, which built the lunar lander. And this, of course, goes back quite a few years now. But because I was the only astronomer that they had available, they started dumping on me because the distance to the moon at that time was not known to an accuracy of better than about 1 mile. And after listening to their complaints a little bit, I finally said, listen, if these guys got to go 240,000 miles, and if 1 mile is going to make make a big difference in that 240,000, they should go back to the drawing boards. So after that, I didn't have to listen to any more complaints. Today, of course, we know the moon's distance to about 1 inch.
And that's amazing. And so what has led to the developments in your ability, through all of your resources, that we have such more specific readings? What have been the developments that have allowed us to get this close to almost perfection in the distances that are so astronomical, if you will?
Well, on several of the flights to the moon, including one of the unmanned flights, a laser reflector was left on the moon. And so here on the Earth, they fire a laser, and they can time how long it takes for the laser beam to be reflected back to the Earth. And knowing how fast the laser beam travels, they're able to figure out the distance to the moon very accurately. Anyway, I worked on Apollo for about 3 years. My responsibilities included determining how accurate the radars had to be on board the spacecraft, how much fuel was going to be used, things of that sort. But after 3 years of that, I then went to work for a planetarium manufacturer, writing canned shows for the planetarium. Mm-hmm. And from that, I became a college professor teaching astronomy, and I also ran the college planetarium. And I trained students to work in the planetarium field. In fact, one of my former students runs planetarium at Bradley University, and he just attended the International Convention of Planetariums. It was held last week in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
It was the hometown of Copernicus. So obviously the local planetarium is named for him.
Sure. Sure, that's fantastic. So the planetarium studies, so you have clearly, especially teaching at the collegiate level, an interest in bringing astronomy to what we might call the average person, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, you've worked on the very theoretical side for scientists, but what is it that you would say for the average person that makes astronomy important for them? Why should the average person take an interest in astronomy?
Well, for those who are religious, Easter, for example, is based on astronomical calculations. For those who are religious and Jewish, many of the holidays are based on astronomical calculations. The same is true for Muslims, as a matter of fact. We're in the holy month of Ramadan, and that's determined astronomically. On top of that, of course, the seasons, the weather, is determined by astronomy. And even if one is not a farmer, people still have to eat, and that means that they're dependent on the farmers, and the farmers better know when the seasons are so they can do their proper planting and reaping. So, you know, that right there is a very practical reason for being concerned.
Sure, sure, both the theological and the very terrestrial reasons.
Yep.
Yeah, and I would say that astronomy for me was something that I remembered, but reading your book, and, you know, as specific as it is, it started to kind of make me reconsider, you know, how much I take for granted of just being focused on Earth itself and what a small part of a solar system, you know, it really is in scale of those things. So we have here in this book something very concrete. And as you said, you know, we know more and more about this. But what do you think in the field of astronomy are some of the still the big unknown, big questions that we still are trying to pin down?
Oh, my heavens, there's so many unknowns. let's see. I mean, just to be very simple about it, how many craters are there on the Earth? We know of about 200, but in fact, the question of what is the largest crater on Earth is very much in the air, because some explorers in Antarctica claimed that they had detected under a couple thousand feet of ice a crater several hundred miles across. That would certainly qualify as Earth's largest crater. Now, I'm not saying that you know, we're in danger of something pounding us anytime soon that's going to leave a big hole in the ground. In fact, that's one of the nonsense rumors that circulates. In fact, we're not about to get hit by anything large. Earth runs into about 100 tons of various forms of space junk every day, but most of it's in the form of something about the size of a pebble, and very, very little of it reaches the ground. It burns up in the upper atmosphere. Let's see, what are some of the other things? If one is an American nationalist, one might be concerned to learn that the Chinese have announced that they intend to have a manned base on the moon by 2025, and it would be a permanent base. And even though there's an international treaty that you can't own the moon or any other celestial body, the Chinese are not a signatory to that treaty.
Wow, it's like the space race has been inverted now. It's gone the other way. Oh, that's fat. I had no idea. And I think obviously what you're saying, all of these are so important, and so important for the average person to know, and to be aware of. And so that brings me to the question of your other writings. So we have here a very, you know, practical, if not essential, compendium for anyone, clearly at the collegiate level all the way up to the highest levels of science, something to have to aid in study and computations. But your other work, I know that you as well write in the realm of fiction. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, oh yes. I've had a time travel novel published, and I also have an anthology of 28 science fiction stories. Well, they're not all science fiction. A couple of them are blatantly fantasy, and a couple of them are blatantly satire.
Ah.
And I've
so
got...
Oh, no, go on. I'm so sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, no, it just the fact of you being a scientist and a fiction writer, and therefore a science fiction writer in the most literal sense, makes you think of someone like Isaac Asimov, who clearly had an intersection of both. So I wanted to ask you about how your hard science intersects with your science fiction.
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I was acquainted with Asimov, by the way. Sorry when he passed away. I'm not the only science fiction writer from the field of astronomy. There are two Russian brothers, the Strugatskys, who are astronomers and write science fiction. And in this country, we have Gregory Benford and a couple of others. So it seems to attract people. As a matter of fact, when I worked on the Apollo project, I polled the 40 or so people that I worked with at Grumman, and it turned out that over half said that they either had been heavily into science fiction in the past or they currently were reading it. Now, of course, it may be that somebody who was interested in science fiction was more likely to work on the Apollo project. I know that when I was called by the recruiter and he said that, I'd heard you were looking and blah, 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 and would you be interested in working on the Apollo project? And I said, I can afford to give you both legs and an arm. And he there was dead silence for a moment, and then he said, I guess you're interested. So, yes, How do they relate? I think that the fact that one is interested in the physical sciences makes one a little bit more likely to be interested in reading fiction that relates to that field. Now, of course, Asimov was not in the physical sciences. He was a biochemist. But he was writing science fiction long before he got his PhD. I think that the fact that one is interested in one often leads to interest in both.
Now, right. No, and I can see the inspiration there.
Yeah, a couple of the things I wrote are obviously fantasy. I have, for example, one vampire story in there. And I also have a ghost story, which is based on a haunted house that was on the campus of the college where I was teaching.
What college is that has a haunted house?
Unfortunately, the house doesn't exist anymore. It burned down. But it was originally built by a brigadier general from the Civil War who made a lot of money trading in ruined Confederate estates, and he bought a fair-sized estate on Staten Island, built his home, married, had three children, two daughters and a son. And the story was that there was a fire broke out in the house. It didn't burn it down, but it caused some damage and annoyed the general no end. And he blamed his son. And when the son denied having had anything to do with the fire, he apparently beat the boy to death.
Boy.
One of the daughters was actually to blame, and the two daughters then felt that they were cursed and they never married. One of them died falling down a flight of stairs when she was quite elderly, and supposedly she and the little boy both haunted the house.
Hmm.
So
those sound like some pretty terrifying ghosts. That was pretty brutal, a brutal story. So, and that was remained on the college campus.
Well, it happened long before the college was there.
Right, and so it was built around that area there. Okay, so ghosts. I mean, that actually fascinates me. The idea. So a man of part science, fact empiricism. So. With ghosts, is that just a realm of creative fantasy, or is there some kind of scientific underpinning there?
I believe in ghosts. No,
okay.
They're not going to find me saying I believe in ghosts. But I can still write a story where it's fun. I have one story in there where the Egyptian god Ra and the Greek god Apollo are talking about how they create a new sun every day. Well, I'm very sorry, but for people who want to believe in those, that's fine. But I neither worship Ra nor Apollo.
Well, I think that's great that I think people have this misnomer often, especially these days, where science is seen so much as the enemy of imagination or creativity and this, this Manichaean dialectic that's shown up between, like, either you believe in higher things or you believe in science and there's no, and I'm glad to see just on a humanized level at least that, to demonstrate to the public that no, scientists have imaginations and a sense of humor and they can explore imaginative realms. You know, it's not just if there aren't numbers to back it up, I won't even discuss it. So it's very refreshing for proof of that. I often try to argue with people that it's not cut and dry. It's not just left brain, right brain.
Science. Scientists are human beings. Some have wonderful senses of humor, and some are sourpusses. Whatever you come up with. I was told by former students that I had a reputation for having something of a sense of humor when I lectured. And in fact, when I did planetarium shows, part of my philosophy of shows was that there should be a certain amount of humor in it just to make it more fun for the audience.
I can see, from talking to you, I can see that, and it's very refreshing.
Well, I don't know if it refreshed people, but at least it helped keep them alert. You know, what's the next joke going to be? I'd point to the brightest star in the night sky and say, that's Sirius, so we can't make any jokes about it. That usually drew groans.
I like that kind of, that's the kind of humor I grew up on. I like that kind of, that hokiness. I think that's so important, and I think that, you know, and it's interesting because the book you've written is very much data-driven and all of those things in terms of just an essential tool and an aid. I'm wondering, are you working on any books? I guess I don't want to say in the realm of popular science. It's not a great term, but any astronomy books for the general public?
No, I'm not. As a matter of fact, my next book is going to be another book of science fiction. I had a character in one of the short stories in the anthology who a number of readers have said they liked him so much that I should write more stories about him. So he was a geologist of sorts. And so I've just finished and sent out to see if one of the science fiction magazines might want to be printing it, a story in which he's at a very early stage in his career, and he has to do field work on a planet of cannibals.
That's fantastic. A planet of cannibals. And what is this character's name, if I can ask?
Well, his name is his family derives from Southeast Asia, although they've been on their own planet for 400 years. His name is Sedathaman Pritikachorn, but because almost nobody can pronounce that, everybody calls him Pretty.
I like that.
It's also easier to spell than Sedathaman Pritikachorn.
Yeah, I'd say there's probably would be a lot of copying and pasting in the documents rather than typing that out every time as you write it.
Fortunately, the computer makes it easy.
Yes, that is one of the beautiful things. And so the science fiction anthology you have out now, just from our readers, because from hearing that alone and discussing this with you sounds fantastic. What is the name of your published science fiction work so that listeners?
The time travel novel is called Time for Patriots, and the reason for that is that major part of the story is set during the American Revolution. So characters in the book include George Washington, Ben Franklin, and also Mozart. Going a little bit further afield, the Bay of Algiers, who very much doesn't like what happens to him in the story. The anthology, is called The Mountain of Long Eyes, and that's the title of the first story in the book also. And I realize it requires an explanation. I deliberately chose that title for that reason. The observatory at Kitt Peak in Arizona, the whole mountain is rented from the Papago Indians. And in their language, a telescope is translated in their language as long eye, which isn't that far off from what telescope itself means. if it's, you know, derived from ancient Greek. So anyway, it's a story in which the tribal shaman of the Papagos battles domestic terrorists who are threatening to blow up the telescopes on the mountain.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That sounds, I love that intersection you seem to have of history and fantasy and all of it, culture. Wow, that sounds wonderful. All right, so the Mountain of Long Eyes.
The Mountain.
The Mountain of Long Eyes.
One of the reviewers said that he thought that it combined real science with magic in a way that was extremely interesting and enjoyable to read, which certainly made me feel better when I read it.
Certainly, no, and it sounds like you have quite the range and all of that. So I'm going to have to pick it up, and I'll have to recommend all of our readers do too. And we're coming to the close here. The robot's going to be on in a second to tell us to wrap it up. So do we have a timeline of when this next piece of yours, it's this next science fiction with Pretty, is going to be available?
Oh, it would be sometime next year, I would think, because I've got other stories that I have to write or complete. I also have several stories that I've started, but I have to complete.
Oh, okay.
And after that, I might think about another astronomy book, but I really don't have one in mind at this point.
Well, it seems like you're keeping yourself very busy. And jumping back and forth between this, fantasy and science fantasy. So it sounds fantastic. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Is there anything you wanted to share with our audience before we end?
If I had a magic word, I'd say it, but I don't. No, I just hope that they enjoyed listening to this.
Yes, well, I certainly enjoyed with you, and I'm gonna have to pick up some of that science fiction, because it really sounds, to be hokey myself, it really sounds out of this world. So,
oh boy.
see, I have my own hokiness too. Well, Mr. Hamilton, it has been a pleasure, and I hope to speak with you again shortly, perhaps about one of your science fiction novels.
Definitely. Okay.
All right. Well, take care, and hopefully we will speak again soon down the road.
Sure, thank you.
All right, thank you for being on the show.
Yep, bye.
Bye. That was author Thomas Hamilton discussing his book, Astronomical Numbers. Astronomical Numbers is available on Amazon.com and through the publisher website. This has been SBPRA Radio with your host, Charles Green. And remember, read on.